Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. Ahead of tonight's third and final presidential debate on foreign policy, we will begin with a discussion of how much foreign policy matters in this election and how much the candidates might steer their answers towards domestic issues. David Rothkopf, the editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine, joins us. He has an article at Foreign Policy, How Foreign Policy Came to Matter in This Election. Then Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, Stephen Walt, joins us. He has an article at foreignpolicy.com, Top 10 Questions You Won't Hear at Tonight's Debate, and we will examine the issues likely to be overlooked since the debate will probably be dominated by China bashing and further recriminations that the Romney campaign have seized upon over what happened at the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Then finally, we'll try to make sense of the latest polls with Margie Omero, the president and founder of Momentum Analysis, a Democratic public opinion research firm whose clients include Democratic candidates, party committees, and nonprofits. We'll examine the divergent polls to try to determine the likely outcome of an election that has narrowed but still seems to give the incumbent an advantage in the Electoral College. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power and Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book is Power, Inc., and he has an article at Foreign Policy, How Foreign Policy Came to Matter in This Election. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be back.
And I find it pretty extraordinary that candidates have basically been told, not the exact questions in advance, but they've been told pretty much what the questions are going to be. What do you make of that?
Well, these debates are all carefully orchestrated all the time, very carefully set up rules and seating arrangements and lighting. And so it's not that surprising that the questions would be hinted at or even vaguely outlined. I think also, though, even had they not been, you would know what the questions would be about.
Well, does that mean, though, that given how critical Ohio is, that, for example, the inevitable China bashing questions will be twisted into domestic issues?
I think everything will be twisted one way or another into a domestic issue. It's increasingly clear that Ohio and perhaps even Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan are central. These are industrial states. They do fear that China has been taking unfair advantage of us in global trade, and I think both candidates will probably go far more extreme in their comments on China than they will actually behave come the next term.
Well, Mitt Romney, in his last debate, he said on day one he'd call China cheaters. I guess he'll walk that one back, but otherwise we'd have a trade war, I imagine.
Well, I think trade relations are going to be a little bit rough in the world for the next couple of years because Europe is soft, we're soft, the big emerging countries are soft, Japan is soft, all the economies are not doing very well. That tends to be when people get their most protectionist. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we do. But the reality is that the U.S. economy right now is so interdependent on the Chinese economy that they hit us or we hit them, and very quickly we're going to realize how much is at stake, and we'll walk it back.
Well, in the first debate where China bashing was fairly replete with it, and the currency issue comes up about the China artificially lowering their currency to be more competitive. Neither candidate, of course, mentioned the extent to which China buys our debt and finances our deficit, which is tied in with its currency. So we don't really, none of these, I guess it's too much to expect nuanced and intelligent conversation here.
I don't think anybody ever won a presidential election talking about monetary policy. I don't think it's the kind of thing that resonates with people. Perhaps it should. The reality is that we are deeply indebted to China. Japan, by the way, is just about to pass China again as being the number one creditor of the United States, but we owe a lot to both of them and to a lot of people around the world, and that's not a good thing for us. If our economy falters, however, it's not a good thing for them, so it's a bit of a two-way street.
So, David Rothkopf, let me read from your article, because I think you summarize the situation, certainly as I see it, of where we stand with these debates. Just quoting you, one reason the conventional wisdom became unstuck, and the conventional wisdom being that foreign policy doesn't matter in this election, you're arguing that it does. One reason the conventional wisdom became unstuck was the president's lackluster performance in the first debate. Had Obama won the debate easily, given his lead in the polls at the time, GOP leaders might have started to distance themselves from their nominee, focus on House and Senate races, and start planning long romantic dinners with Marco Rubio, or potentially even longer ones with Chris Christie, with an eye to 2016. And the two remaining debates, including the foreign policy debate, would have mattered less. So, given that the president essentially was a gift to Romney, Romney was pretty much dead in the water, and suddenly, because Obama didn't challenge his etch-a-sketch from 2 years of campaigning as a right-winger to this overnight moderate, I mean, a lot of people have reconsidered him, and basically they're saying to themselves, well, this guy's not as bad as Obama said he was. Maybe Obama's lying. I mean, do you see this as a catastrophe?
Certainly the first debate was produced the biggest swing in an election of any debate that I can remember. It was, I think, a 50%+ swing by some polls in terms of the number of people who thought Romney won versus the number of people who thought Obama won. So it was a very, very big margin. And the story since then has clearly been momentum shifting in Romney's favor. Part of that, I think, was Obama's lackluster performance. Part of that is that Romney was a caricature until he walked up onto that debate stage and he started to talk and act like a human being. And, you know, he has produced some bad policies and he has made a bunch of gaffes. But he's also a thoughtful, accomplished man, you know, with sense of humor and who's done some good things in his life. And so it's hard for him to have stayed the caricature after these debates also.
Well, that's not to say that his trip in the summer abroad, which was supposed to give him foreign policy credentials, you refer to as the global gaffe tour. It certainly was.
You know, it was disastrous. And I think his foreign policies thus far have been, you know, kind of a neocon nostalgia tour also. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, let's go back to the Bush policies. We're going to be tougher. Whatever Obama does, I can do it with more troops, I can do it with more planes, I can do it with more explosions, I'm going to stand up to the Russians, I'm going to stand up to the Iranians, I'm, you know, a lot more testosterone. Having said all of that, in each of the other debates, Romney has, as you indicated, pivoted a bit, moved more towards the center, just as almost all candidates in the Republican Party do, and the Democratic Party, for that matter, when they get into the general election. And the interesting thing to watch tonight is going to be whether Romney can move more to the center and appear more measured and more reasonable and more presidential than he did during that summer of error after error after error.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and is the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council, Superclass, the Global Elite, and the World They Are Making. And his latest book is Power, Inc. He has an article at Foreign Policy, How Foreign Policy Came to Matter in This Election. So given that there'll be probably talk on, let's start with Libya. I mean, the Republicans really think they've got an issue there with Libya. Do you think the president will point out the obvious, which is that Libya is in post-revolutionary chaos, which is not surprising given decades of rule by a dictator, and that, if in effect Syria will end up the same, you know, so since we're not in the business of boots on the ground, what do you expect? You know, that I imagine that's just far too adult a conversation to have, right?
I think it is, although I think the president might well make that kind of an argument effectively because that kind of cool, measured analysis is a strength of his. I think Romney, on the other hand, will say, look, you said that you were going to make us safer. And look at Libya, where al-Qaeda was involved in the attack. Look at Syria, where al-Qaeda is involved. Look at Yemen, where al-Qaeda is involved. Look at Iraq melting down. Look at Afghanistan, where the Taliban is resurgent. The Middle East isn't safer right now. This is because the Middle East is in complete uproar, and it is because the United States can't actually make it that much safer. But that's a very hard argument for the president to make, because Americans do like to think that we're masters of the universe.
So what about then in two of the debates, in the vice presidential debate and in the last presidential debate, both Biden and Obama mentioned that the person who's choosing Romney's judicial nominees is Robert Bork. And that certainly, I think, it gives people pause. But surely if he were to point out that Romney's foreign policy team is dominated by the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq disaster, the only winner of the Iraq war was Iran, and that unlike him, who, you know, has people that have real foreign policy experience and aren't these reckless utopians who have caused so much damage, doesn't that bring into question Romney's judgment already, that he would bring back this disastrous crew?
Not only does it, I expect you'll hear something almost exactly like what you've just said in the context of the debate. Just as in past debates, you've seen Romney try to pivot to the center, you've also seen Obama try to say Romney's a throwback to Bush policies or Reagan policies that got the U.S. into a lot of trouble. And I think he's going to do that on foreign policy just as he's done it on economic policy. He's going to say, this guy's surrounded by neocons. They want to go back to war in the Middle East. We've seen how reckless that is. We can't afford to do that. This man is dangerous. I think that in some ways, the debate's going to come down to which of these two guys can most effectively make the argument that the other one is more dangerous for the United States than they are.
So what about Israel, the so-called third rail here of U.S. foreign policy? The Romney administration has been making hay and trying to say that Obama put daylight between Israel and the United States. I don't know where he got that idea from. But he keeps repeating it, and he also says that Obama has thrown Israel under the bus. Now, maybe that's playing down in Florida, where the polls seem to have indicated a surge in Romney's favor. But how does the president deal with this? Because it'll obviously come up, particularly, I think, in the context of the red line that Netanyahu drew on that cartoon before the United Nations, vis-a-vis striking Iran sometime in the spring.
Well, I think the president will say what the president has said, which is that we're as close to Israel as we've ever been, that we've got a good open discussion, that he's been talking a lot to Netanyahu, that we're aligned in terms of our objectives, and that he will not allow Iran to get nuclear weapons. And Romney will then say, well, you're not really close to Netanyahu, and you're not really, you know, and you haven't really been fully supportive of them, and you are on the verge of letting Iran get nuclear weapons. And it's going to be kind of he said, she said, because, you know, what's the retort? I personally think the U.S.-Israel relationship's not in particularly good shape. I also don't think that the issue is as important as everybody says it is. I'm sure that the shift in Florida has more to do with the fact that Florida is really a rather conservative state than it does with any sort of predisposition towards Israeli issues. I think, actually, the biggest problem for Israel is that it is becoming a less important political issue in the United States than it's ever been, and that the concern that some of the Israelis feel is not so much the Obama administration. It's that the U.S. Wants out of the Middle East. The U.S. is energy independent. The U.S. would prefer not to spend a lot of money policing that part of the world, and old historical issues are drifting into memory.
So given that in the last election, even though they talked about energy and didn't bring up climate change, which, you know, is a national security issue in lots of other countries, I believe that the CIA have got a division that's looking at climate change as a national security issue. But these two candidates seem to stay away from it. And in terms of what you just said, surely that would be a good teachable moment for the president, wouldn't it, to point out how we've got to diversify our energy use? I mean, one of the things I find extraordinary about the Republicans is that recently in the House, the Secretary of the Navy was castigated by the Republican chairman of a committee because the U.S. Navy has got into biofuels and alternatives because they don't want to be dependent upon the Middle East, particularly with a navy that operates on petroleum and petroleum products. So that seems to be a wise national security decision on the part of the navy to have alternative sources in case there is the Straits of Hormuz are closed, for example. Do you think the president has an opening there?
Sure, I think there's a great opening there. I think you're absolutely right, by the way. I think it's ridiculous that the Republicans would attack the Navy for doing what makes a lot of sense, particularly when it was a Republican administration, the Bush administration, that set ethanol targets for the United States actually at a level above that can be reached. But having said that, there isn't a big international issue that doesn't have energy as a central component of it. Whether it's the Middle East or whether it's climate or whether it's the rise of big emerging powers or whether it's the fact that right now it looks like the Chinese are going to spend more money on alternative energy than every other country in the world. They're going to lead in that technology. We are going to follow so long as we follow the path that Romney and the Republican Party have been advocating. So, I think it's a very important issue. It is an opening for the president. I'm not sure how it will resonate, and you particularly have to look at Ohio, where, sort of borders on the Marcellus Shale region, and where a lot of poor, depressed communities are saying, gee, this shale boom could really be the thing that turns it around, and they see Obama as an opponent of rapid embrace of shale, and therefore energy is a bit of a double-edged sword in some of these key swing states, like Pennsylvania also.
Well, but the president hasn't dealt with the coal issue. The coal people are trying to make him an enemy of coal, and they're pushing this myth of clean coal. And the reason that coal is, it's the market forces that are putting coal out of business, not Obama, because of all this gas that's coming online because of fracking.
Well, actually, the reality is coal's not being put out of business. Coal gets shipped overseas, and somebody else will buy it. They're just not going to buy it here. To be fair, if you ever went in Barack Obama's Senate office, it'd be in the lobby. There were two display cases, one of which was full of coal mining equipment. He's from Illinois, and his views towards coal and are actually much more welcoming of what I agree with you. I think clean coal is a bit of a myth, but he has embraced that myth because it's politically convenient.
Well, just in closing, David Rothkopf, again, editor-at-large at Foreign Policy magazine, where he has an article, How Foreign Policy Came to Matter in This Election. Clearly, the president is not a leftist. He's a centrist. If anything, his foreign policy is quite hawkish, and he's been touting his killing of Osama bin Laden. So in many ways, that will checkmate Romney, because he'll be out hawking Romney on so many issues. But isn't there a danger that he's going to alienate the already alienated American left who are unhappy about the use of drones, et cetera?
I don't think there's any danger that he's going to alienate the left, because the left hears you about Bork and hears you about the neocons and, fears what might happen with the Supreme Court and whether they agree with the president or not on foreign policy. They just can't abide what Romney represents in terms of social policy. But I do think that you're absolutely right and that there is legitimate and important left-wing critique of the president because of drones and kill lists and cyber war and serial violation of the sovereignty of other nations, pulling away from the G20, and most of all, doubling down in Afghanistan, which was costly, catastrophic, and at the end of the day is actually not going to produce any benefit for the United States, measurable or otherwise.
Yeah, that's. I think a lot of people tell me that place is going to really go to hell after this election. So I guess the less said about that, the better, right, for Obama?
From the Obama perspective, absolutely.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, David Rothkopf.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine. He also is president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power and Superclass, the Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book is Power, Inc., and he has an article at Foreign Policy, How Foreign Policy Came to Matter in This Election. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the top 10 questions you won't hear at tonight's debate.
handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs,
I just don't want. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing.
And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walt, who is the Robert and Rene Balfour Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. He also co-wrote, along with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, and has an article at foreignpolicy.com, Top 10 questions you won't hear at tonight's debate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Walt.
Nice to be with you.
And we'll get to the top 10 questions, but basically you're saying that tonight's debate will be the most rancorous and least edifying of the three debates. Explain.
Well, I could be surprised, but I think that we're not likely to get a lot of enlightenment here, in part because there's just not a lot of difference between the two candidates on foreign policy issues. President Obama has, in fact, implemented a fairly centrist, maybe even center-right foreign policy, a rather hawkish approach to many international problems, and that doesn't leave someone like Governor Romney much room to attack him from the right. Americans from the political left might have a bit of a beef with the president, but Romney can't really go after him on very many issues without sounding like he's someone who either wants to waste a lot more money on defense or who wants to start a few more wars, and neither of those positions is likely to be very popular with the American people. So instead of substance, you're going to get a lot of posturing from both candidates, particularly, I think, from Governor Romney, and a lot of rhetoric, but not a lot of real substantive policy difference.
Well, clearly, Romney will go after Obama on Libya, which the Republicans, from the very beginning, before any information came in, have tried to turn into a political issue. And I'm surprised that the Obama White House has let it get this far. They're in a bit of a bind, though, aren't they? I mean, the extent to which Libya is in chaos then plays against their narrative of having liberated Libya. But on the other hand, maybe a little honesty about the fact that there's about 1,700 militias and no central army or police, and and that the U.S. can't send in the bombers, as the Republicans now are saying he should have done. Why not tell the truth about it rather than keep sort of defending what clearly looks like not the most competent response to a terrorist attack?
Well, I don't think actually Governor Romney can make a lot of mileage on Libya. First of all, most Americans just don't care that much about what happened in Libya. They're bothered by the death of the U.S. ambassador. But it is not, it seems to me, a vital interest for most Americans. Second, it's hard for Romney to argue that the United States should have done nothing. Does that mean he thinks we should have let Muammar Gaddafi remain in power? Third, there's not much enthusiasm in the United States for getting more directly involved in Libya. And perhaps the one thing you can point to is that there should have been better security for the embassy. But that that's usually not the direct responsibility of the president. And finally, Romney's own response on Libya has been somewhat precipitous. And one of the points I think President Obama will try to make throughout the debate is that running foreign policy requires some mature judgment. You can't just, come up with snap ideas or snap decisions in response to the first reports you get. And that Romney throughout the campaign has tried to score gotcha points, sometimes before all the facts were in. So I'm sure that Romney will bring up Libya, and I'm reasonably confident President Obama will have a pretty good response on that issue.
So do you think...
Well, we'll see.
Well, what about tying Libya into Syria in the sense that Romney, even though he's not specific, is suggesting that somehow we should be doing more to help the rebels there? But Syria will end up probably in a very similar situation as Libya is, assuming eventually Assad falls. You still have chaos, and you still have, because that is the legacy of dictatorship. They don't allow for political plurality, and in the end, you end up with extremes. That's what's happened in Libya. That's what's happened, will probably happen in Syria. And that's, to me, that's just an adult argument.
Right, but the central point that both candidates have is first of all, the interesting issue on Syria or Libya is all in the details. Exactly what do you think the United States should do, at what cost, with what forces, with what diplomatic or possibly other instruments of power you'd be willing to use. Just to say we ought to be doing more to help one side or the other begs an enormous number of questions. How do we know which opposition groups really deserve our support? How can we be sure that the weapons won't get diverted into the wrong hands, etc.? President Obama and Governor Romney, I think, both will want to stay away from specifics here. President Obama, because he can't necessarily talk about all the things the United States is already doing there. And Governor Romney, because he doesn't want to be too concrete and specific, because, again, it makes it sound like he might be a little bit too eager to get the United States embroiled in another quagmire. My guess is, again, Syria is likely to come up, but you're not going to see a lot of substantive policy disagreement.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Oranges of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he co-wrote, along with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He also has an article at foreignpolicy.com, Top 10 Questions You Won't Hear at Tonight's Debate. Well, what we will surely hear at tonight's debate is more China bashing. Is that a fair bet?
I think we'll get some of that, yes, because there's lots of survey evidence suggesting that one of the most important foreign policy issues to many American voters is the idea of preserving American jobs. And China is often seen incorrectly, in my view, as the principal source of, say, high unemployment in the United States. So my guess is you'll certainly see Governor Romney talk about how he will get tough with China. And I think you'll see President Obama argue that he has both been tough where it was appropriate to be tough with China, but also has worked to manage a relationship with a very important economic partner. There you might actually see some real disagreement, but in a sense it tells us more about American domestic politics than what's right in our foreign policy. Because although Romney may talk about getting tough with China, lots of people say that when they're running for office, and then once they get into office, they discover that starting a trade war with China is the last thing they want to do, particularly when the American economy is also pretty fragile.
But Romney, in his last debate, said on day one he'd call China a global cheater, which probably will start a trade war. So he's already opened that door. But I think your point...
There's a long tradition of people saying things during the campaign and then not doing them once they're president. And I think much of the China bashing you might hear tonight falls in that category.
Well, clearly, China bashing is, I think, related to Ohio, is it not? And Wisconsin to a lesser extent, that it ties into the jobs narrative. And how do you think both candidates will pivot towards domestic issues? Because to my mind, they know what the American voters are interested in. And as it happens, this last debate is about something that the American voters aren't as interested in as domestic politics. At least that's the assumption.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. It'll be fascinating to see how they try to remind everyone of their domestic positions. My guess is that, you know, Romney will sound a little protectionist, which isn't his real position. He'll certainly sound strong about trying to bash China, and I think President Obama will come back and point out how both diplomatic and economic program has promoted international trade, which has benefited the American economy in a whole variety of ways. My guess, that's maybe the one part of the debate where you're going to see some eye-glazing, wonkish detail get thrown back and forth. But I don't think it tells you very much about what foreign policy either candidate would actually follow in office.
So, Stephen Walt, let me go to one of your questions here that in the foreign policy article, top 10 questions you won't hear at tonight's debate. Number two, gentlemen, neither of you have served in the U.S. military. Governor Romney, you have 5 grown sons and none of them have ever served. President Obama, you have 2 daughters, one of whom will be eligible to enlist in 4 years. Have either of you encouraged your children to serve our nation by enlisting in the armed forces? If not, why not? That's an easier question for Obama. Nobody's going to tell a 15-year-old girl that she maybe she's 14, that she should be thinking about enlisting in the army. But you have real evidence of the 5 sons, and in Romney himself, he demonstrated in favor of the Vietnam War, yet got an exemption to become a Mormon missionary.
That's right. I think, though, that both the candidates ought to be probed on the tendency for American politicians increasingly to talk about how much they love the U.S. military, how much they want the country to be strong, how much we need to support the troops, provided, of course, that their children actually never have to serve. And that's obviously the case in the case of Governor Romney and his son. But it seems to me it's worth asking President Obama if he's ever talked to his daughters about the fact that this is an option, a way that you can serve your country. You don't have to simply go off to college go to grad school and get a law degree and then become a politician. There are other ways to serve. And has he ever raised that as an option? Did Governor Romney ever talk to one of his sons about maybe serving in the Navy or the Air Force or the Army? And given that both of them are going to try and represent themselves as strong defenders of American national security, it's worth asking whether they think those sacrifices extend to their families as well. It's worth noting, by the way, that Vice President Biden's son did serve in the military and I believe served in Iraq. But that doesn't tend to be something that most American politicians do and most American politicians' children do.
I believe there's only a handful of congressmen and senators whose sons and daughters are in the military. But if you've spent any time in the White House, the whole place is awash with military aides. So it's unlikely that the Obama daughters aren't aware of the military.
Of course not. And I'm sure that Governor Romney's sons were aware that this was something they could do if they chose, and they chose not to for whatever reason.
So, Stephen Walt, in terms of your 10 questions here, obviously Afghanistan is one that neither candidate particularly would want to talk about. The truth of the matter is it's going to go to hell fairly soon after the elections, isn't it?
I think we actually don't know that. I don't think we're going to get a particularly desirable outcome, but things may turn out somewhat better than we might think. The point is, they're probably not going to be substantially different than they would have been had the United States not had the surge ordered in 2009 and had the United States chosen to draw down much sooner. The fact that we fought for the last 2 or 3 years has probably not altered the political equation in Afghanistan in any predictable way. And it seems to me this is one of the places that Romney could legitimately criticize President Obama, except if he did that, he'd be attacking him essentially from the left, which is something he doesn't want to do. So you end up with, in this case, 2 candidates that are basically Tweedledee and Tweedledum. They both think the United States should get out of Afghanistan. They both think we should get out at about the same time. And there's really no substantive difference between their positions there.
And number four of your top 10 questions, you won't hear tonight's debate, Stephen Walt, is about the threat of climate change. They both candidates had ample opportunity to refer to climate change when in the last debate when they talked about energy use, and it didn't. Neither broached it. So you expected there to be a deafening silence on tonight on climate change?
One thing to understand about tonight's debate is that the topics have been already selected by the moderator, Bob Schieffer, and they've already been told to the candidates that they're going to focus on a series of issues, most of which revolve, by the way, around different aspects of the greater Middle East, including Afghanistan, Iran, Israel, Palestine, things like that. So climate change was left off not by the candidates, but by the people organizing the debate. That said, it is certainly striking that an issue that may be among the most, if not the most, important long-term issues facing the United States and the rest of the world is completely absent here. I don't expect it to come up because it's impossible to talk about climate change without basically implying that the United States is going to have to alter the way it does business in a variety of ways and that it's going to involve some costs. And costs are not something that either candidate really wants to talk about tonight.
Well, there's a very popular feeling and somewhat justified. You know, remember George W. Bush referred to America being addicted to oil. He didn't go on to say that the war in Iraq was a drug war. And further, the fact that we are so dependent upon this part of the world that's causing us so much grief would indicate that maybe the solution is to get off the drug. And why not bring that up?
Well, I guess they may talk a little bit about that. And for example, they might talk about how the United States has the prospect of being energy independent through hydraulic fracking and other modern technologies that may be, you know, creating greater reserves here in the United States that we can exploit. The problem is that if you drive the price of energy down or you give the United States energy independence and we continue to consume fossil fuels at the same rate we are, that makes the climate change problem worse. Once again, I think that's just going to be an issue that both candidates try to stay away from.
So what about the red line on Iran that we saw Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel draw that cartoon at the United Nations recently? He's been somewhat silent since because the evidence that the sanctions are working in Iran are pretty manifest with its currency dropping by 90% in a year and people demonstrating in the streets of Tehran and other cities. And even the Bazaaris now turning against the government. Don't you think Obama's got a strong argument there? Because clearly the argument that Romney's been putting forth so far of Obama throwing Israel under the bus has been working. I think that may explain what's happening in Florida with the polls changing in Romney's favor.
I think there's actually very little difference between the two candidates on the Iran issue. They've both stated that they oppose Iran getting any kind of nuclear weapon, that they both make it clear that the military force is an option they would consider using to prevent that from happening. The problem for Romney is it's hard to take a tougher position than President Obama has already taken without making it sound like you're getting ready to go to war. And it's hard to run for president in almost any circumstances by promising the American people that you're going to get them involved in another war, let alone another Middle East war, as soon as you've moved into the Oval Office. So he can't sound too hawkish. And because President Obama's position on Iran is already pretty hawkish, too, there's just not a lot of room for Romney to stake out a position that's substantially different. So he may try to you know, argue that Obama has been too naive, he's given Iran too much time, etc. But Obama can always come back and say that he prefers to let diplomacy run its course and see if there's any way we can accomplish our objectives without having to go to war whose results might be unpredictable. That's actually going to be, I think, a tricky issue for Romney to handle without, again, sounding like he's too willing to put Americans in harm's way. And by the way, Americans in harm's way when we're not even sure at this point that Iran has a nuclear weapons program.
But just in closing, why not bring up the neocons? In one of the last, I think it was the last debate, or maybe it was Vice President Biden brought up the fact that the judiciary appointments for the Romney administration will be decided by Robert Bork. Why not mention that the neocons who brought us the disastrous Iraq war, which Iran won thanks to their stupidity, now every one of them will be in his cabinet. It'll be George W. Bush's foreign policy all over again.
Well, not every one of Romney's foreign policy advisors is a neoconservative, but there are a number of prominent neoconservatives left over from the Bush administration who are playing important roles in his sort of foreign policy brain trust. And I actually believe it would be very effective for the president to point this out, simply to say that if you had your problems with George W. Bush's foreign policy, you might have some real problems with the Romney foreign policy if they had that much influence. And for that matter, President Obama could ask Governor Romney point blank, given the track record of these individuals, why are you relying upon their advice? You know, I choose to take the advice of people who have been much more successful in handling foreign policy. You're relying on advice from people whose track record is really quite dismal. What does that tell us about your ability to pick advisors, ability to staff a government? I think that might be very effective, but at some level, I don't think I'm going to hear that tonight. It's a little too personal. It's sort of not President Obama's style, but we'll see.
Well, he's already lost one debate by being so passive or absent. So if he wants to win, maybe you should take your advice. I thank you for joining.
He certainly won't be passive tonight. That I'm not worried about.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us, Dr. Stephen Walt.
Nice talking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who is Robert and Rene Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's also the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he co-wrote, along with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And he has an article at foreignpolicy.com, Top 10 Questions You Won't Hear at Tonight's Debate. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a Democratic pollster about how much this third and final debate will affect the outcome of this election.
It's all about strikes now, so it would strike in me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Margie O'Meara, who is the president and founder of Momentum Analysis LLC, a Democratic public opinion research firm based in Washington, D.C. Her clients include the Democratic candidates, party committees, and nonprofits around the country. She was named a mover and shaker by Campaigns and Elections magazine and one of the 50 Politicos to Watch by Politico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margie O'Meara.
Thanks for having me.
And the polls are all over the place. A Gallup poll shows Romney holding a 6-point lead among likely voters. And then Investor's Business Daily shows Obama up by 4 points. And then the Wall Street Journal, NBC, have the race tied at 47% apiece. The latest poll from Democrats is the Democracy Corps, the poll by Stan Greenberg's company. They have a poll of likely voters that has Obama back at 49% to 46% for Romney with a 2% third-party candidate. What's your polling tell you?
Well, I think the polls are going to be all over the place. And that's just how polls are when you have a tight race. And, you know, our polls show the same thing as, you know, tight race just like everybody else. I think it's important to note a few things. First, what matters is not the national poll per se, but how the race looks in swing states. Swing states, some states are, you know, some states are tied and are have a tight base, and some states are moving toward Obama, like Ohio or Wisconsin, that have been, you know, really solidly trending toward Obama, I should say, trending rather than maybe solid is a little strong. But it's going to be a tight race. I mean, I think, make no mistake, it's going to be a tight race, and that's why you see the polls bouncing around. It's also very difficult to exactly predict what turnout will look like, who's going to vote, and who's going to show up. And the last thing I would point out is early voting. Early voting is going to make a huge difference in this election. You may have about a third to 40% of people who are voting are going to vote ahead of time, not in person on election day. And sometimes it's harder to for the national polls to get a perfect read of who's voted early and how they voted.
So the likely voters, though, have most of those polls have put Romney ahead. And does that indicate more enthusiasm on the Republican side? Democrats traditionally have a problem with turnout. They have a natural majority, but their challenge is to inspire their natural majority to show up. Now, where do the Democrats stand in terms of inspiration?
Well, I think, you know, you have a lot of people who on the ground who are enthusiastic about the president. I mean, the president, obviously, a re-election campaign is going to be different than you know, running for the first time. And I think it's a mistake to look at the difference in enthusiasm from 2008 versus now and say that that somehow means that the president's doing something correct. It's really a function of just running for re-election. I think one thing that's been true about Mitt Romney, and it continues to be true, I mean, first, make no mistake, the first debate cost the president some support. That's true. He admits that, and I think that's obvious from the polling. But make no mistake, Mitt Romney does not engender a lot of enthusiasm for Mitt Romney. He's been net unfavorable almost the entire year, essentially. And he, you know, he has not really created the sort of goodwill at the grassroots level at all. And, you know, people who are excited about Mitt Romney are excited because they don't like the president, they didn't like the president last time, and they don't like the president this time. So I don't think you're going to see a lot of folks who swing voters who are just really excited about Mitt Romney. They're just folks who are trying to figure out how to make sense of our economic climate and are, you know, moving around based on what they see in the debates and what they see in television advertising and so on.
So, Maggi Amer, again, president and founder of Momentum Analysis, a Democratic public opinion research firm based in Washington, D.C. Her clients include Democratic candidates, party committees, and nonprofits around the country. So, given that the first debate was a disaster for the president, and I think the main consequence for that was that the president had effectively framed Romney in his commercials as being out of touch, and of course Romney helped with his 47% remark and other gaffes on the stump. But suddenly that seemed to disappear overnight because people, the so-called swing voters, saw his performance in the first debate and thought he was actually, you know, for the first time they entertained the possibility of him actually being presidential. So that cost Obama all of that time and money. But how does he make it back? Once the swing voters made up their mind that somebody that they thought of negatively suddenly appears to be reasonable, and you know he etch-a-sketched his entire right-wing agenda overnight and became a moderate, how does Obama make up for that lost ground?
I think he does a few things. First, he communicates his vision for his second term. It talks about the clear contrast between his view and Mitt Romney's view. And you know, really reminds voters of the failed policies of the Bush administration that created this economic mess that the Romney administration would bring us back to. I think the last thing you would do is really demonstrate which candidate has a shared, you know, really embraces and understands Americans' shared struggle. And there's really no contest there. I mean, Mitt Romney has demonstrated time and time again that he just has difficulty really understanding what average people go through. And the 47% comment, it wasn't a gap. It was a real demonstration of his philosophy, which is half of the American electorate thinks they're entitled to food. That was actually the language that he used. And Paul Ryan, his running mate, has said things similar. He said 30% of the electorate wants to have a welfare state. And they just show, you know, and he has his plan is to cut food for hungry children. So it's really you really see between the two of them a real contrast. And I think it's important for Obama to talk about, and I think there's a way to talk about that, even though the debate tonight is foreign policy, and then continue to make that contrast headed into the home stretch.
So, Margie O'Meara, again, president and founder of Momentum Analysis, a Democratic public opinion research firm based in Washington, D.C. Her clients include Democratic candidates, party committees, and nonprofits around the country. The 2004 election, in many ways, is similar to this one in the sense that it's going to be fought out in the Electoral College, and it's down to Ohio. And I've spoken to a lot of people who worked on the Kerry campaign in Ohio, and the consensus is that the race was stolen in Ohio. But of course, had that not happened, Karl Rove, of course, working in closely with the Republican Secretary of State in Ohio at the time, and now we have a similar situation with a Republican Secretary of State in Ohio and Karl Rove out there with billions more at his disposal. What's to stop him stealing this race, particularly if it gets close? Before the first debate, with Obama 10 points ahead, there was no question, I think, that voter suppression would be sufficient, along with all this hidden money from these big super PACs that Romney has. So does that mean, I mean, I don't want to seem cynical, but I'm trying to be realistic here. As if it's a really close race, doesn't that invite chicanery?
Make no mistake, the other side is engaged in some serious voter suppression tactics around the country. You have state legislators who have been fighting for laws that would make it harder for people to vote, and you have one state legislator saying on camera, we passed voter ID law, which is going to help elect Mitt Romney for president. That's what they said, right? And you have it trumped up paranoia about voter fraud that simply doesn't happen. Not that we should have or encourage voter fraud, but the amount of effort and resources that have been devoted to fighting something where really, truly, only a handful of cases actually have been found. And you have, you have folks in court admitting that they don't have any evidence of actual voter fraud. So there are people showing up to the voting booth and saying they're somebody else. In order to vote when they shouldn't. That almost never happens. It just rarely happens. But yet you have, in battleground states, you have Republicans arguing very persuasively and really with some success that we should have this, so have these laws. And so it's causing a lot of problems that you, it's something to really should be concerned about for any listeners out there who aren't sure if they are eligible to vote, or students who are trying to vote where they go to school as opposed to at home. That's another group that's been targeted. Wherever you are, just make sure that all of your registration's okay, and that you comply with whatever the new laws may be in your area, because it's something that is really an issue in a lot of areas around the country. And I can't speak to somebody's going to steal the election using, you know, doing something that's illegal. But we should, as voters, as citizens, watch out for anybody who is trying to make it harder for anybody to vote and to see if there's a pattern. And the pattern definitely is to make it harder for seniors, minorities, and students to vote. And those are all folks that, downscale seniors that vote Democratic, all those groups. There was an example last week of somebody who worked for the Republican National Committee who was found throwing away voter registration cards, registering people to vote and then throwing away the registration. And that's something that is not new to this election cycle. It's happened before, but it's definitely a pattern and it's one party. It's something we should really, really pay attention to because it's incredibly serious.
In other words, the person that was registering people to vote was registering both Democrats and Republicans, but threw away all of the Democrats who registered for Democrats. That's the pattern. Of course, here in California, today is the last day to register to vote. So that's a significant today is a significant day in itself. Just in closing, Margie O'Meara, I mentioned Stan Greenberg's latest poll. He's saying that Obama's back to a 49-46% lead, but with 2% voting for a third-party candidate. Now, that brings back memories of Ralph Nader in Florida in 2000, although the numbers for the Green Party have gone down consistently since Nader, and largely that it's not a party that's built itself up as a party so much as a vehicle for personalities to jump aboard, like Ralph Nader, Cynthia McKinney, and the Greens, of course, almost ran Roseanne Barr this year by a few votes. So they're not a party that's building a party so much as being hijacked by personalities. But the Libertarians are a real party with a real ideology. So what do you know about this 2% factor?
I think after President Bush, there's no mistaking that there's a major difference between the two parties. And we see that now. We saw it in the Bush administration for sure. And I think that a lot of folks who may be interested in a third party don't want to risk at all the chance that we're going to have President Romney and Vice President Ryan. And I think that same thing is probably true with right-leaning potential third-party voters, that, they may be inclined to vote for Romney and Ryan. They don't want to risk what they see as a potential victory. So I think when it comes to a third party in this country, it's just not, people don't want to feel like they're wasting their vote. I do think that there is an appetite certainly there's an appetite for an argument that we should be working together. We should have more collaboration, and that politics has become too partisan, too angry, too divisive, and that makes a third party attractive. But ultimately, people want to feel that they're voting for a winner, and if you are voting for a third party candidate, you're not voting for a winner.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Margie O'Meara.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Margie O'Meara, who's the president and founder of Momentum Analysis, LLC, a Democratic public opinion research firm based in Washington, D.C. Her clients include the Democratic candidates, party committees, and nonprofits around the country, and she was named a mover and shaker by Campaigns and Elections magazine and one of the 50 Politicos to watch by Politico. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Muhammad. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments, and the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.